This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit chevrolet.gm.ca.
Hi, this is The North This Week. I'm Dave King. On the show today, we're going to hear about UFO sightings in Yellowknife, about a man who's out for a 7,000-kilometer stroll, and about a northerner on a mission to find good homes for orphaned books. But first, people in Kimmerut are still reeling from the second RCMP shooting in less than a month. Constable Douglas Scott was shot and killed while responding to a drunk driving call in the little community at the southern tip of Baffin Island. The 20-year-old officer was working alone at the time of his murder. So was Constable Chris Warden when he was shot and killed in Hay River in the Northwest Territories last month. His widow, Jody Warden, believes her husband would still be alive if he had been required to take backup. She says the RCMP should order more than one officer to respond to every call. Warden is also calling on the RCMP to hire more police for the North, more experienced officers in particular. To help put those issues in perspective, CBC's Kirsten Murphy spoke to two senior members of the RCMP this week. Sergeant Mike Inglis is with the force in Vancouver. He's working on a policy that specifically addresses many of Jody Warden's concerns. We'll hear Kirsten's conversation with him in just a moment. But first, she spoke to Sergeant Larry O'Brien. He's a member of the Northern Force at the RCMP detachment in Yellowknife.
Now, Jody has said officers should not have a choice when it comes to deciding whether or not to take backup. What do you think?
Well, at present, the system works in that the officers have discretion as to whether or not they're going to bring backup with them, as you know. Certainly, there have been concerns for a while about members attending alone, specifically when they're called out in the middle of the evening, because generally when a member is called out, nobody knows where he or she is going except for the telecoms operator. And if something goes wrong, then it's up to them to try and find the member. In this case, they couldn't get in touch with Chris, and then call back up from there.
So, can I interrupt just for a sec? When you say telecom, is that person based in Yellowknife?
Yes, they are,
okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So this has been an issue for a while, and, you know, it's nothing new. I think for years we've been talking about the safety of members going out in the middle of the evening by themselves. With regards to members attending all complaints alone, It's a tough question, really. Certainly, there are situations during the course of any business day where you know, members can handle certain complaints by themselves. And I think the thinking goes that they probably in the middle of the evening when they're called out, they can handle certain complaints on their own. The problem is that you never know what's going to happen from the time you leave for a complaint to the time you return from the complaint. Dynamics change quickly, and situations change quickly. So it's not necessarily, you know, what you attend that the issue is, it's what happens on the way there, on the way back that creates the issue. And certainly we've looked at this for years about members attending alone.
Larry, what about, I mean, we've heard about chronic staffing shortages also for years. So is it realistic to be thinking there could be multiple members going out on calls?
Well, I think at present there's, I don't know what the logistics would be in terms of manpower, et cetera, but I don't see how it would be possible for us to attend every complaint with at least two members. You look at some of our smaller detachments of two and three members, it's impossible for them to work 24/7, 365 days a year and have at least two people attend every complaint. I mean, it's just, I don't think it's physically possible at this time, and I don't know what it would take to make that possible.
And with these two fatalities, the issue of experience has come up. Mr. Constable Scott was only 20, and Constable Warden, I think, had 5 years' experience or so. Is there a concern about the type of how much experience officers have when they're coming up here?
Well, the reality is right now, throughout the RCMP, we're extremely junior. It's not just the Northwest Territories or not just Nunavut. It's every division is very, very junior. Recently, I was speaking to colleagues in Alberta, and they talk about how junior they've become. And this is a symptom, really, of the fact that our membership are getting older, retiring at an incredible rate. As you know, over the last few years, we've been ramping up Depo to try and keep up with the massive amounts of retirements. And everyone that comes out of the out of Depo is new. Like, we don't bring 5, 6, 10-year constables out of Depo. They're all brand new. And that's what we have to replace lost experience with at this time. Now, having said that, the recruits coming out of Depo are better trained than ever before. So they, you know, theoretically are better capable of handling issues right out of the box than we were 15, 20 years ago. The other thing with experience is it's not necessarily tied to years of service. Certain detachments are busier than others. Certain detachments have allow officers to see various sorts of crimes more than others do. You could have a 10-year member who's worked in very quiet places who doesn't have the experience of a 4-year member who's worked in very busy spots. So it's not as simple as saying we're too young or we're too old. We certainly have issues right now with the fact that we have lost a lot of senior members and we're replacing them with new recruits. And, you know, for the next few years, it is my understanding that's going to be the case. We're going to lose a lot of people through retirement and we're going to have a lot of recruits coming out of Depo.
Do you think the deaths of these two officers is going to hurt recruitment in the North?
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to answer that question, to be honest with you. I don't know how it'll affect recruiting. You know, I know when we're talking about members attending complaints alone, if you work in a large municipality in Lower Mainland British Columbia, you know, you're probably never going to work alone. But up here, the reality is at the present time, you are going to work alone. Will that affect people's decisions to come up here? It might. At the same time, maybe it'll spur people to come up here. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you for coming in, Larry O'Brien, Sergeant Larry O'Brien. Sergeant Larry O'Brien is with the Yellowknife RCMP Detachment, and the RCMP are working on a new policy that speaks directly to some of Jody Warden's concerns. Sergeant Mike Ingalls is with the RCMP's Staff Relations Program, which handles labor relations for the force's 20,000 rank-and-file members. For the last 2 years, he's been working on a policy that makes backup mandatory in certain situations, and he joins me on the line from Vancouver. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, can you give me some of the details of the policy in terms of what kinds of situations would the RCMP officers be required to ask for help?
Well, I think just as some context on that, I think, just to mention that the RCMP is one of the last major police forces that doesn't have a backup policy currently in place. So our members go out there, and I would agree with Sergeant O'Brien that that our members come out of Depo extremely well-trained. But the public needs to keep that in context. It's only 6 months of training, and then you come out into the real world, and it's not a scenario. But the backup policy would make it mandatory for members going to a call that they know there is violence, or to a call where it's a known domestic dispute, or where it's known that there's a weapon, where it's known that the person may be emotionally disturbed, a situation where a person has a mental illness, that we would definitely send two people to those types of calls. And I think it would take the pressure off the members that are out there in terms of their decision-making process. They say, no, I know I have to take a second member. And the organization would have to account for that and have the proper resourcing in place.
And my understanding is the policy talks about multiple member responses versus backup. What's the difference?
Well, sometimes a police officer, and again, as Sergeant O'Brien said, every call that you go to isn't initially known to be a high-risk call. In those cases, you need to call for, when you're calling for backup, you're at a situation and it does begin to escalate. You need to be able to call for someone and have someone readily available that you're not just calling out into thin air hoping that someone's going to show up to provide backup. A multiple member response would be that we don't dispatch a member to one of these calls where we know the risk to be a higher risk.
And how would you expect that calls, how they're handled right now, how would that change with this new policy?
Well, I think it would take some of the pressure off. I've talked to members from the north. Yesterday, met with a member that's done relief duties up in Nunavut, and I can tell you that your decision making process at 2 o'clock in the morning, knowing that your partner didn't go to bed till after midnight because they were out at calls, is a lot different than it is in the light of day. And I think it's to allow for better decisions to be made, and that the decisions, quite frankly, aren't based on the cost of calling someone out.
And Sergeant Ingalls, what about Jody Warden's suggestion that more than one officer should respond to each and every call? Is that something your committee has been looking at?
Well, that was certainly a consideration given on that, and I can tell you that on the labor relations side within this organization, that we had a number of people within our working group that suggested that. The backup policy, as it's currently drafted in the RCMP, allows for some flexibility. There are things within a community that we don't have to have members go to, but you do have to have backup very closely available. So I think Mrs. Warden would be, if she saw the backup policy the way it's drafted, and again, it's management hasn't put this one into place. But if she saw it as it's drafted, I think she would see that it is quite comprehensive.
And is this policy being drafted in response to these two deaths, or was it already on the books?
No, this is for the last 15 years, there's been internal reports saying that these are high risk situations, 1-2 person detachments, small areas. And I guess we've been going full tilt on it probably for the last 2.5 or 3 years. I guess what is called the final draft of the policy has been completed since July of this year.
Sergeant Mike Inglis is with the RCMP in Vancouver. He's the chair of a committee working on a policy that requires RCMP officers to bring help for all potentially dangerous situations. He was speaking with CBC's Kirsten Murphy. Excused for thinking that Fabien Doucet's plans for this winter are a little odd. Fabien is from France. Not that that has anything to do with being odd, although it is the country that made Jerry Lewis a star. Fabien Doucet is going to spend this winter walking clean across the Canadian North. He began his journey in the Yukon in the spring, and he's now in Fort Smith in the Northwest Territories, waiting for the Slave River to freeze up so he can walk across and continue his trek. Doucet says his greatest challenge so far was the Canol Road. He describes what he faced there through translators John Blythe and Geneviève Côté.
I guess the biggest challenge to him so far has been the Canol Trail, because what he had done at the start of his trip was that he was going to go totally self-sufficient. So basically, he was packing all of his own gear and there was no resupply until he got to Norman Wells. The second major component of this that made it hard was he had decided to go without any communication, so no radio, no sat phone. Once he got to the Canol Trail, he was delighted to discover that the digital topographic maps on his GPS contained only the beginning of the Canal Trail and the end. He's pretty mad at the Natural Resources Canada, or the government body that's responsible for the topos. The paper maps that he did have were at a really big scale. I think he said 1 to 1 million. The other difficult part for the Canal Trail is that because so few people are doing that route, as time passes, nature is reclaiming the trail, so there's less and less of the trail that's visible. There's lots of places where it's totally washed out and it's totally overgrown, so you're kind of like basically trying your hardest to pick up where the trail is. And so it was pretty difficult for him not having the maps and the trail not really being well defined. because he started, he was self-sufficient and he only had a limited amount of food, there was definite pressures upon him to like really get going and move fast because, right, there was no way for him to phone out if he needed more food. So it was like, the only way I can do this is to go forward. So it was really kind of like, whew.
And then physically too, because the nature is taking back on the trail, there was places where there's absolutely no road and he was carrying his carrick at first, the little thing with wheels that allows him to bring his gears, and he had to leave it behind on the trail because it was just impossible to continue with that. So he had to leave a part of his gears on that too because he just couldn't carry all that stuff on him. So physically it was a really, really big challenge too.
Yeah. There were sections of the trail where he says that it was really steep and rough going and he had so much stuff that he had to actually run like three trips up and down sections just to get all of his stuff there. And then he would cross, there would be river crossings, right? He was having to do the same thing across rivers. It's really difficult to carry your stuff across the river and then come back empty-handed and go back across the river with all your stuff. And it was pretty challenging physically and mentally.
The next little bit of Doucette's walk will take him overland from Fort Smith to Churchill, Manitoba. With temperatures and snow falling, good luck to you, Fabien. A little while ago, Verna Firth's house became a pretty busy place. The phone was ringing a lot, and all sorts of people were dropping by to see one specific video. It's one that she and her husband shot early one morning a few weeks ago. It shows a strange bright light hovering in the sky over the little community of Delaney, just outside of Yellowknife. All kinds of people saw the light. It was there for several hours, starting around 5:30 in the morning. But so far, Verna seems to have the clearest video footage. CBC's Randy Henderson spoke to Verna about what she's seen.
What did you think when you and Bruce got this early morning phone call about this unidentified object in the sky over Delaney?
Well, you know, at first we got a call like 5 o'clock in the morning, and we didn't even bother to answer that one. And then we got another call, my sister-in-law called at about 6:30, and we didn't answer that call either. When we finally got up at about 7:30, the phone was ringing again, and my sister was telling me about it. So we looked outside and couldn't really see anything. And then we noticed like a star that wasn't usually there was just situated right across, facing out to the middle of town.
Mm-hmm.
So we grabbed a video camera and just kind of looked at it and kind of just was just out in awe, saying, what the heck is that? You know, not knowing what it was, whether we were looking at it, because we never noticed it there before, eh?
So what does it look like, Verna?
It looks like, when you look at it with your naked eye, it looks like a star. But it looks like it's really close, really, really close.
Mm-hmm. And so you have it on video.
Yes.
So, what do you think it is?
Oh, God, I don't know. I have no idea. I can tell you what I think it is and what everybody's perception of what an unidentified flying object looks like. That's what it looks like.
Wow.
The perception, what they depict on TV, what they show in movies and all this, that's what it looks like.
You mean like a flying saucer kind of thing?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So were you scared? Go ahead.
Yes, and tell you the truth right now, Bruce is outside recording again.
What?
It's there again.
It's there right now?
Yeah, and my kids are kind of nervous. And
wow, so people in Delaney, have a look outside there and look up. You'll see it.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So were you scared at any point there, Verna?
Well, this morning I was, but like the first one, it was kind of exciting to see all this stuff and like to zoom in and actually see the details on this thing up in the sky. Like it's round and it has circular circles going into the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
And inside it, there's little black dots that move around within the shape.
Really?
And then it'll glow green on the outside, then it'll glow purple. And then it'll move closer and go back further and go sideways. But it just stayed there for hours.
And it's there now, right now?
And it's there right now, yes.
Now, I understand you had kind of mixed feelings about coming to talk about this on the radio. Is that because up to now you've been a skeptic about these kinds of things?
Well, I've always been a skeptic about stuff that are, like, the unknown. Like, who's to say whether I'm right or wrong? Who's to say, like, I'm some kind of crazy person trying to, you know, say that I saw this and saw that? And I've always thought that about other people who say or come in the media or wherever saying they've seen this and they saw that and, you know, without any proof.
Mm.
But we have the proof, and I know I'm not crazy.
Now, what have other folks in Dale and Abe been saying to, you know, if they've seen it as well?
Oh, it's they're amazed. There's some people who are just amazed and wonder, like, what the heck is that and why is it here?
Yeah. Well, I understand that Bruce has been answering the phone by saying, UFO Center.
You know, by luck of the draw, when your reporter called, that was the first time he ever said that.
Is that right? So what are you going to do with this video, Verna?
Oh, I have no idea. We've got my friend Mark. He's really, really, really a computer wizard, and he came over last night because we have it on an 8mm camera.
Mm-hmm.
He came over, and he captured the video on the computer and burned it to a DVD for us so mm-hmm. that it's easier to, like, to handle it and to watch. So I'm not sure what exactly Bruce wants to do with it, or so it really it's up to him.
Yeah. Well, I remember last winter there were folks in Norman Wells who were seeing you know, UFOs and from several sources, several witnesses. Have you reported this to the military or anybody else like that?
Actually, there is a website on the computer. It's called UFOcenter.com, and they have a form on there to click on to report a sighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and did that on, I think it was Friday or Saturday, I think I did that. So,
yeah.
But I haven't received anything back from them. Apparently, they get a lot of hoax or fake sightings reported and stuff, so I guess it's hard for them to pick out the real ones from the fake ones.
Yeah. Well, Verna, we'll have to dig into this further, but thanks for your eyewitness account, and good luck in seeing it hover over your community.
Thank you.
Verna Firth and her husband have video footage of the strange, bright object seen over Delaunay recently. What do you think? Have you ever seen a UFO in the northern sky? We'd love to hear about it. Send me an email at dave_king@cbc.ca. They're one of the most endangered caribou herds in all of Canada, and they're going to become a big issue in an environmental assessment of a major hydro proposal on the Churchill River in Labrador. Overhunting, logging, and low-level flight training have all taken their toll on the red wine caribou herd. There are just 85 animals left. Some of them are wearing radio collars that are tracking the herd's movement over 10 years. CBC's Paul Piggott obtained maps that show those movements, and he prepared this report.
The maps show hundreds of tiny dots, each representing the position of a red wine caribou in a given year. Over the last couple of decades, researchers have had radio collars on up to 20 animals in the herd. The maps show the location of those caribou between 1996 and 2005. Most of the dots on the map cluster to within 50 kilometers of the Gull Island Rapids, exactly where Newfoundland and Labrador wants to build a dam. The dam would also flood 120 square kilometers of land along the banks of the Churchill River. Some biologists say that hunting pressure has driven the herd from its traditional area in the Red Wine Mountains south to the Churchill. Clarice Blake-Rydkowski chairs the environmental group Grand River Keeper.
We concur with what we see on the map because some of our members have said that they've seen caribou even down around the Causeway and Bridge area. So we know that this herd is using the river going back and forth. Here's a herd with only 85 animals on the brink of extinction and certainly should be a concern for somebody.
In fact, the herd has been the subject of intense study going back to the time when NATO Air Forces trained in the air over the red wine herd. Researchers followed some caribou from birth until death. They found that caribou weren't dying from the jet fighters. It was the bullets from local hunters. As the herd declined to critically low numbers at the beginning of this decade, the province struck a deal with the Innu Nation to ban hunting and protect what was left. Then, in 2004, the province published its recovery strategy for three woodland caribou herds in Labrador, including the red wine. but the strategy doesn't deal with the potential impacts of new roads, logging operations, and now a major hydro development in Cariboo country. Clyde Jackman is Provincial Environment Minister.
Our officials are finding, you know, in consultation with natural resources and other people who are studying this herd, that they are generally confined to a particular area. And whether or not they will be impacted by the Lower Churchill project, that this will all come out through an environmental assessment process. And we put our faith that we have a good process in place in this province, therefore that will all come, work its way through, and I'm certain that every effort will be made to ensure the protection of that herd.
Jackman says a Cariboo action plan is also nearing completion, but it's not clear how that plan will deal with hydro development. He says that issue is up to Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro.
The proponent has to develop a plan around this herd, if indeed they are in that area, and secondly, that it has to meet the standard and the expectation that as it comes before my department and this government. I mean, you know, that this is not different from any other project in the province.
The impact of flooding on woodland caribou is well documented. Many biologists point to the flooding of Lake Michikamau in the 1970s as a major reason for the decline of Western Labrador's Lac Joseph caribou herd. They say critical calving grounds ended up underwater beneath the Smallwood Reservoir. But Gilbert Bennett, Hydro's vice president for the Lower Churchill, says it's unfair to compare the current proposal with the Upper Churchill project.
The flood area for the Lower Churchill is much smaller than what we've seen for the Smallwood Reservoir and the rest of the Churchill Falls development. You know, we're talking about, in round numbers, 120 square kilometers compared to thousands of square kilometers in the Smallwood Reservoir.
Bennett won't say how often red wine caribou are using the river valley. They've been collecting data on that since 2004, but Bennett says conclusions won't be released until the company's environmental impact statement is complete, probably sometime next year. But there is some suggestion that the Lower Churchill development could indirectly help the red wine herd. CBC Radio spoke anonymously to a longtime caribou researcher with the province. That person says the river valley is a thick forest, terrain that's crossed but rarely used by caribou. The researcher says that flooding would instead destroy moose habitat. That could be a good thing for caribou because moose attract a higher population of wolves, and wolves hurt the population of caribou. But that's all speculation. For now, Gilbert Bennett says it's too soon to draw any kind of conclusions.
We do know that they move through the region, and what we will report on in the environmental impact statement is the extent to which they do. It's a little premature for us to get into that right now because we haven't finalized the environmental impact statement. So just to talk about the process, you know, as we complete the data collection process, we'll incorporate all of that into the EIS, and then all of those impacts will be discussed through the environmental assessment process.
Bennett says Hydro is also looking to another mega project in Quebec right now to see how developers there are trying to work around caribou. He says the best way to minimize the impact on red wine caribou still has to be worked out.
It's a matter of, you know, the environmental assessment process to determine the extent of the impact and then what strategies we might need to use for mitigation. I think the important point right now is we do recognize that herd is within the area of the project.
Of course, environmentalists say the best strategy is not to dam the river at all. Blake Rutkowski says the red wine herd will be one of the major arguments against another hydro project.
Here is an endangered species that could be further endangered with the development.
Officials with the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency say that consultations with the Innonation about the Lower Churchill Review recently wrapped up. That means guidelines for the panel are expected to come out any day, and it looks like the red wine caribou will be a major heading. In Happy Valley Goose Bay, I'm Paul Piggott.
Thanks for that report, Paul. I'm Dave King, and you're listening to The North This Week. I'm Dave King, and you're listening to The North This Week. And if you're listening in Yellowknife, perhaps you drove by Squatter's Bookstore last week and noticed a little note on the door. It said, "Closed for the week. Slaying dragons." Owner Darren Letts shut the shop down, not to do inventory or to take a holiday, but to deal with an overflow of books he's trying to give away. CBC's Joanne Stassen dropped by the shop a few times last week to find out what the note was all about. And as she discovered, there are book lovers, and then there's Darren Letts.
Dawson City, learning about Escape, Story of the Underground Railroad. I found some really neat stuff.
There is no place Darren Letts would rather be than surrounded by books. The shelves of his bookshop in Old Town are stuffed with everything from literary journals to detective novels to the classics.
A book is an artifact that we have a relationship with, and I am definitely polyamorous. It's irresistible, and I wouldn't be in this profession if I didn't have a strong affection for books.
And he's gaining a reputation for that affection in the community.
Some mornings I come into the bookstore, and I will see a little bundle in front of my door, and I know that someone trusted me to take care of these little orphans, and I do my best to find a home for every book that has the capacity to survive.
But these days, Darren Letts has a lot more orphaned books than usual.
Yes, every room in my shop, which consists of about four rooms, is filled to the thighs with books that need to find homes.
Novels, nonfiction, hardcover, softcover, and clothbound, picture books, children's books, self-help, and popular science. These are the leftovers from the Yellowknife Public Library's book sale. Librarian Deborah Bruiser says until Darren Letts came along, getting rid of what they couldn't sell was always a struggle.
We would have endeavored to have found homes for them, and it has been a challenge until Darren Letts wandered into our lives. Certainly his track record has been excellent in getting books into the hands of different literacy groups, into the hands of individuals who can use them.
And although he runs a business selling books, Letts isn't making any money from this arrangement.
And because they are former library books, they must remain in the public domain. It's not appropriate to sell them. It's not appropriate to destroy them. So they are finding a safe harbor here as we make this bookshop into an orphanage of sorts. And we just need a lot of people to adopt these books.
In some cases, a private adoption is arranged.
A piggy gold, you are my darling.
Folk musician Jim Taylor is the proud new parent of a book on maritime folk songs.
I was playing my regular Saturday night gig, and I went outside between sets, and Darren was standing out there. He said, "Jim, you're just the guy I want to see. I have a copy of Maritime Folk Songs by Helen Creighton." He went on to tell about giving books to good families. And he said, "I thought of you when I saw this book, and I wanted to know if you'd like to have it." And I tore it out of his hands and said, "Of course I do."
Little lady fair.
See, that's a different line than the one I'm used to singing.
And it seems Darren Letts has a bit of a sixth sense when it comes to these matchups. It turns out Jim actually met the book's author in the 1960s.
I actually think Darren might have liked to have kept a hold of it. I think he had a tear in his eye when I said I'd take it.
And I myself.
Darren admits parting with books is not easy for him.
If I'm going through these boxes and I see something that I may chance never to see again, I will spend a little bit of time with it. Unfortunately, it's not the most efficient way of getting rid of 3 tons of books in 1 week.
Of course, that means a lot of these homeless books need to be adopted en masse. Several boxes will go to Tanzania through an arrangement with a local Lutheran church. Darren's also worked with the Northwest Territories Literacy Council to select a dozen boxes for small communities.
I definitely don't want to drop books at a place where the books will simply occupy space and not be picked up and read, so I'm trying to target the readership of each site where I'm dropping the book.
And the Harry Potter, those cloth-bound ones,
okay.
Those would be best donated to an institution because they'll last forever.
So like libraries, schools, that sort
yep.
of thing?
Look like almost brand new.
The books?
Yeah.
They are.
Yeah.
Some of them. That's it.
Darren watches a van pull away with a load of books heading to Ray Edzo.
People in the community have been stepping up and helping. I've had people help me lift stuff out of the library. Dennis Bevington's staff opened up one of their unused offices, and I was allowed to dump a huge number of books there. You know, other people have loaned vehicles and that sort of thing. The strategy is simply to trust in the goodwill of the community and the community's love of books.
But even a bibliophile like Darren Letts admits some books are simply unadoptable. Outdated science or medical books, books that exist in large numbers, or books that are damaged.
There are some books that I feel comfortable euthanizing. I will break their spines, causing them as little pain as possible, and then I will say a few words, and then I will drop them into the recycle bin.
But despite these tough decisions, Letts says being a foster parent for all these books has its rewards.
When someone comes in and I have the book they want, I get to sell them a book, and that feels really good. But when I have an armful of books and I can give them to someone and those are the exact books they wanted, that is a priceless experience. I'm banking that as karma, and it's feeling really good. All right. This is the last.
I'm Joanne Stassen in Yellowknife.
A raccoon's first year. Newspaper theater.
Thanks for that piece, Joanne. It brings us to the end of The North This Week, but if that's not enough for you, you can find more stories from across the North on our website at cbc.ca/north. As always, I encourage you to get in touch with me, especially if you've got a good UFO story. You can reach me at dave_king@cbc.ca. I am Dave King. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.